September 18, this is comprehensive emergency management plan update at 10:30.
Well, first, we'll do some introductions. Of course, I'm Chair Bledsoe, and I'm the Emergency Manager for the Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency. To my right is Eric Frank, who is our Emergency Response Planner and responsible for the draft. So, of course, any specific questions about drafting or draft language, I will turn to him. We also are privileged to have a representative from each of our response disciplines with us. To my left is Robin Albrecht. She's at the Public Health Department, so represents the Public Health Discipline. To her left is Donovan Matter, who represents the Clark County Fire Chiefs Association. To his left, Rusty Warren, represents law enforcement from the Clark County Sheriff's Office, and Pete Capel, of course, from Public Works. These four discipline groups represent each of the agencies that might take the lead in any type of emergency or disaster response. So they are with me today to ask any answer any level of questions that you have in terms of any operational procedures or things that we have. So Eric's going to be the PowerPoint. We submitted this to Rebecca in advance, so I'm not sure if you've seen it in advance or not. But to begin the presentation, the reason we're before you today is that the Comprehensive Emergency Plan comes up for review every 4 years. The last time we reviewed this plan was in 2009, and the basic change that occurred in 2009 was bringing the City of Vancouver and Clark County into one Comprehensive Emergency Plan. So we melded the Comprehensive Plan to include both Clark County and the City back in 2009. 2013, our update is relatively not as significant as it was back in 2009, but we'll go over the specifics of what's changed in the past 4 years. We have to submit our plan to the state of Washington, to the Emergency Management Military Division, by the end of this year, by December 31st of 2013. We're before you today to receive any feedback or collect any wisdom that you have prior to taking it out to the city. So we will, after we have your tentative approval, begin work on incorporating the review and feedback of the cities, Vancouver and the other six cities that we represent. We also want to refresh your role as commissioners during emergencies. I just read an excellent article on NPR this morning about the role of elected officials in terms of no one goes into their role expecting to have an emergency or disaster. But as we're seeing in Colorado just this week, that it can be a very defining and pivotal moment in each of your careers. And then we also want to make sure that you understand the difference between tactical and policy decisions. And that is one of the most difficult things that occurs during a disaster, is kind of where are the lanes in terms of where elected officials reside and what decisions are made at a tactical level, which are represented by the agencies here. So any questions before we move forward on that? All right. So what is the Comprehensive Emergency Plan? Essentially, people ask us often whether or not we have a plan for every separate type of emergency. You know, what's your windstorm plan? What's your snowstorm plan? But the reality is one Comprehensive Emergency Plan covers essentially how we respond and coordinate at all levels to all sorts of different hazards. So there's a number of things that happen that we kind of all do together. That is ascribed to the Incident Command System, and so we manage every emergency, despite its origin, in roughly the same way. Now, there are some intricacies based on the type of hazard, and so sometimes there are additional annexes and information that is added in based on the specificity of the hazard. So, for example, we have a pandemic flu plan and things that are slightly different than what is handled in what is covered in the Comprehensive Emergency Plan. So that's why we say many hazards, one basic method. Also defines disaster and emergency responsibilities during crisis. Who does what? Who's on first? When do we get together and unify and make decisions together? And then which agencies have the lead responsibility depending on the type of hazard involved? So it establishes our organizational structure. It identifies what divisions and departments are tasked with certain responsibilities. And it outlines the process for how we handle public information during instructions to the population so that they can best prepare themselves during a disaster. Next slide, please. We have the emergency plan because it's out of the order of not only RCW 3852 at the state level, it directs all jurisdictions within Washington State to have an emergency plan, but it's also governed by local code as well under Clark County Code 2.48 and the Vancouver Municipal Code M3513. The Crescent Director, my boss, is actually responsible for the preparation and development of the comprehensive plan. So it is stored at CRESA. There are drafts that are available online so people can access it at any given point in time. And of course, it's just good planning practice. You want to make sure we have a plan in place before the actual disaster comes our way. Next slide, please. So we update the plan, like I said, every 4 years on a cycle. The plan is constructed in such a way that there is a base plan, which is what you're reviewing today, and then there's a number of emergency support annexes that go more specifically into the types of capabilities and types of response needs. So the base plan says, here's how we organize, and the emergency support function annexes 1 through, I believe, 15, 16, at this point, cover various specifics of that. So for example, there's an emergency support annex on emergency operation centers. There's one on transportation, there's one on law enforcement. And so what happens is every 4 years, we update the base plan, and then in the other 3 years, we're updating the annexes with the groups involved that are responsible for that annex. So for example, the transportation annex is led by our public works agencies that are involved in governing transportation. Our ESF 8 over public health issues is sort of governed by our public health entities. And so the plan is always dynamic. So a lot of times people will see the word draft and say, your plan always says draft. And the problem is it's dynamic. It is constantly always being reviewed and updated based on exercises, based on real life events that have happened. And then every 4 years, we have to do this comprehensive look at what's going on. We review all of the edits and vet them with our emergency response partners. So we have visited with each of the agencies that are to my left, gone through the plans, if you have any heartburn over the roles and responsibilities, and they've given us feedback, which brings us to the draft that we have today. So what are the changes? Going very specifically into the changes that we have is, essentially, it's a shift in emphasis this year to not just being response, but what are also your role in prevention in prior to the emergency happening, and what might be your role in recovery after the disaster has occurred. A response is actually a pretty limited window of time. When a disaster happens, the response stays in effect, so to speak, until all of the live bodies are handled. And then we go into a community recovery part, which can take months and sometimes years for communities to recover. And so the recovery phase is very long. Response is actually pretty short. And so our shift in emphasis is to incorporate not only pre-disaster, the planning time, but to include response and also to include the recovery angle. So it's much more comprehensive in looking at all of the avenues of response. We also want to make sure we define the responsibilities for each discipline. So each of the response disciplines know exactly what could be, might not be, or are a part of their responsibility. Now, I'll be honest with you that we don't have resources in this county for each discipline to do every single one of the responsibilities that are listed. Unfortunately, most disasters don't require them to do everything at once. But for example, Public Works has a lengthy list from, you know, changing up roads and road closures to, you know, a huge, very list of things that when push comes to shove, they may be able to only fulfill 3 or 4 of those responsibilities. And then we will be looking at additional response from the state or mutual aid support partners to help supplement the abilities that we have and the resources we have in this jurisdiction. We also want to affirm relationships, not only between agencies, but our cities, our counties, and our mutual aid partners, so that we're clear on if we don't have the resource in our jurisdiction, who will be responsible for helping us and who will help us in that process. And then finally, we outline the resources that we might need to acquire, things that we might not have now here in Clark County that we may need to receive from the state or other jurisdictions if we don't have connection to those assets.
Sure. When you say during an emergency, are you talking about during the crisis itself, or are you talking about the recovery phase as well? Because obviously acquisition of resources continues well beyond,
yes.
You know, if you hit that 500-year flood,
yep.
You know, not only do you have to have the resources available to be able to deal with the crisis at hand, but then you have to be able to acquire resources to help you through the recovery phase.
Yes.
Is that included in here?
It is included, but recovery is much more comprehensive and whole community. And a lot of times what happens in a recovery is the community sort of has to come forward and provide what level of support it can to get its community back on the road to recovery. Those discussions come very much to a policy level decision of, you know, what support can the county offer, what support can the state offer, what support will FEMA bring into a jurisdiction, which is never enough to actually help a community fully recover. And then what resources are out in the community that can kind of come forward and help community members. We still have, for example, Hurricane Katrina, areas of Katrina, New Orleans, that are still not recovered because they simply didn't have community or assets able to fully recover those areas.
Well, that's why I'd love to see a menu of those options available. So that, I mean, and that's a great example. You're years later and you still have these pockets of that are just destitute. is there a menu of options so that when we, you know, if we do have a crisis, that as we get through that first crisis phase and now we're looking at, all right, now what? You know, as the waters recede,
right,
now what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? What are the resources we have locally, state, federal, and how are we going to get them quick,
right,
so that we can actually help people get back to work, get back to their lives,
yeah,
otherwise?
And a lot of those come down to very specific policy decisions that you make as elected officials about what level of support you can give the community. And
I get that, but support using what? That's what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
The menu that I want to see is the menu of what resources might we provide? What resources might we go after for state, federal, other jurisdictional partners so that we have that in front of us and that we're not having to scramble around and figure out, like, oh, is it general fund? What am I talking about? You know, and having that all there.
And what we're identifying is a sort of a compendium of best practices of what other jurisdictions have done. And what happens with recovery decisions is that they're very often very politically fraught. And I'll be honest, because sometimes there's tax incentives that are used. There are reductions in sales tax, reductions in property tax, and decisions that have economic impacts across the jurisdiction. So what we're able to identify is what have other communities done, but they are going to have to be decisions, you know, that you have to make in the context of your bigger scale as well.
I definitely don't. I'm not asking you to decide what I choose from the menu.
Right, exactly.
You know, what we as a board would end up choosing.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying it'd be nice to know what the menu looks like.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank
we
you.
Can do. Eric is my response planner, but I also have a recovery planner, and I know putting together a recovery framework is one of our goals in this coming year. And so we will definitely be bringing that to you as an update. So not as part of this plan, but as part of our community recovery plan. So.
That's great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Sorry for
interrupting. No, please, we do. Because the recovery is a very, very difficult issue. And even at a response level, there are assets that we don't have. We have had situations that we had a train derailment a couple of years ago where we needed a very specialized crane to come in and upright a train that was only available in Spokane. And so there are a number of mutual aid partnerships and relationships that we've had to do to bring some assets to the jurisdiction, even for things that don't rise to the level of disaster, but just our emergency response issues. So, any questions?
Yes. I think what Commissioner Stewart is asking for is where is the information deposited, especially if we're facing a crisis totally unexpected. Time is life, and I assume that there must be a website where all of this is, where you've got your quick reference notes, all the major contact information for the individuals. What is that website?
We don't have a website with all the contact information in terms of, I'm not quite sure what you mean in terms of
shouldn't
contact
we?
Information. Well, we have what we call an emergency notification directory where we have access to all of the backdoor phone numbers that we have for you know, the assets and the resources that we use. There's a regional resource directory that folks have access to that allow us to have 24-hour access to a number of business entities and a number of recovery to our response type assets. The question, though, a lot of business owners don't want that information publicly available because they don't want to receive those phone calls unless it truly is an emergency or disaster. So they're held inside the EOC, and we have access to them at the different emergency 911 centers throughout the region. So we have it across that as well as our partners.
Okay. What I'm wondering about is who's included in the we? If the if the commissioners are to be part of that we, then I would think that there's two levels of access to the information. One is what's available to the public, and the other is what is access to the key people that are charged with the responsibility of communicating with the rest of the team.
Right.
So I would think that
our emergency responders all have 24-hour access to information through the dispatch center, and they can simply key a radio, they can call the dispatch center and ask for a duty officer to be paged, and they can receive access to the information. Our incident commanders from the variety of the disciplines have automatic access to that any day or time. We don't have access to a lot of those numbers to the general public simply because they are, you know, business owners, you know, cell phone, 24-hour contact, and they're not for typical consumer-type resources.
But for the emergency commissioner, because we have one commissioner that serves in the policy group and that is the emergency commissioner, does that emergency commissioner have access to all of that?
They have access to our duty officer in our 911 center at any given point in time, and access to me as well. So, yes, you would contact. The issue, and we'll get into talking a little bit about commissioner roles here in a minute, is that our incident commanders, when we talk about the incident command system, an incident commander has the tactical overview of any type of emergency response. So they are making the life and the death decisions and the response decisions related to that. Policy decisions are a little bit different because policy decisions are asking you to do a number of different things: declare an emergency, spend a lot of money, or break laws, or potentially reduce civil liberties in order to enhance life safety. So those are the four basic types of things that we will be bringing to you as policy decisions. Of course, you guys have the ability to stay informed at any given point in time of any emergency by connecting with us in the EOC, and we'll get you information that you need from the emergency response. And a lot of times you'll see, from a public information standpoint, people will be looking for who's the spokesperson for the event. And so as we're talking about your roles as commissioners, we want you to very much stay informed. We send out information on a daily, sometimes multiple times a day when we're in an emergency response, to give everyone a situation report, to give them information about what is happening in the emergency response. But the incident commander of any emergency is the one who has the automatic access to all the emergency response information that they may need or be able to acquire during an emergency event. Do you guys have additional information about your staff?
That information does need to be limited. When you have the incident commander on the scene attempting to utilize resources, he really wants as little competition for those resources as possible. So if those numbers are given out to a lot of different people and everybody's calling these resources and saying, hey, can you come help me? It begins to be a problem where you're stripping resources out.
So we certainly want to limit those resources or the information so that they don't get tapped out. But at the same time, it really has to do with what role the commissioners are to play to make sure that we're, in our attempt to make sure that we don't overtax and have multiple people speaking in and tying up the bandwidth of those that are really already maxed out. What is our role to make sure that we're equipped with those numbers? I know that last time we had our exercise, I ended up putting in my cell phone the contact information for each of the individuals and put a little code there so I know where to go to in case there is an emergency. But I want to make sure I'm kept up to date, that each one of us are kept up to date. So if something happens, we know who to call. If the 911 center, if the crisis center is no longer operational for some reason, or we lose cell phone service, what's the backup plan for radio? How do we communicate?
So we use a number of different backup communication and ways to get in touch with folks. And actually, if you will shift to the slide in terms of commissioner responsibility, I think we'll answer that very question. So right here, this is where we begin to really define what your role and responsibilities are with regards to an emergency. And of course, your first and foremost role is to stay informed of the emergency. And what happens in an emergency response is the Emergency Operations Center and the EOC manager becomes the conduit to the elected officials. So whoever, either myself or whoever is in my role, will be tasked with briefing you regularly about what is going on with an emergency. So if we get into an EOC activation, you can expect that there's at least a policy briefing once, if not twice a day. And sometimes what we do is have a briefing in the morning and one towards the end of the day so that you're up to speed both as the day kicks off and as your day ends about some of the key decisions. We will also ask for your time anytime we have any decisions that need to be made and the emergency cannot move forward without having your input on particular types of decisions. So if, for example, we needed any type of code or ordinance shifted or amended or exempted, we need to bring that to your attention. The very first decision that we always bring you is declaration of an emergency. And so that is often the very first meeting we'll be having. We'll give you a scenario of here's what's going on, here's what we're facing, here's why we might ask you to declare an emergency. Now, there are some thresholds that are involved in that. FEMA gives us some fiscal thresholds at about $1.5 million of damage to public property. And so we're always watching that as an emergency response to identify, are we truly in an emergency or are we not? And or do we need to have any either civil liberties restricted or any codes waived in order to respond to the emergency itself? And so, for example, during the H1N1 swine flu situation, people had different feelings about whether or not that was really an emergency from a public perception angle. But from our angle, we had to ask the commissioners to declare an emergency because we needed paramedics to be able to give the swine flu vaccine. And that was a law that needed to be accepted in order to allow paramedics to give the vaccination. And so anytime where we have a law that might butt up against the emergency response, we will be bringing that to the emergency commissioner first and then to the following Board of County Commissioners hearing the next Tuesday so that you're up to speed on what happened. And so we will be briefing commissioners. Our policy group actually is not just you as commissioners. It also includes the city managers of the cities as well as a mayor from each of the managers, each of the cities involved. So we have our emergency commissioner, our county administrator. The other roles that are included include your information officer, your risk manager, and your attorney. Prosecuting attorney who sits at that table so they can advise, you know, where the law is and is not with regards to emergency response. And then we also bring subject matter experts into those discussions as well. So if a situation is heavily law enforcement, you'll see the sheriff or sheriff's office representative or any of these core disciplines who are giving you sort of the status update of what's happening. Yeah.
So leadership is absolutely imperative in a crisis like that. And so I want to make sure that we understand that the incident commander, Caressa, and how you've got your plan set up to work, you are the lead. And we are not, our role is to make sure that you're never waiting for us, that you can contact us. But the way a plan is set up to work is that we aren't necessarily expected to call Caressa. Rather, Caressa is going to call us and keep us informed and help us to know what we can do so that we can facilitate you as quickly as possible.
Yes.
Just want to make sure I understand
that. Just to clarify, Cressa's not the lead, and I'm going to describe it sort of as a marriage.
Okay.
The incident commander, who's in the field, so one of these four disciplines is going to be the incident commander. Cressa, at the Emergency Operations Center, does support and coordination. So essentially, everything that these four disciplines can turf off to the Emergency Operations Center, they do. So, for example, Rusty might be charged with a law enforcement incident, but he may have some additional responsibilities like feeding his crews, sheltering and evacuation of some folks. He may have some things that he wants to keep his law enforcement folks focused on the law enforcement mission because that is their primary responsibility. So he gives off support issues to Cressa, and the Emergency Operations Center is not the lead tactically. We are the lead of doing any missions that they give us. Now, where we step in and do some additional things is at an information level. If we have multiple incident command posts going on, we will be involved in the coordination of information. So, like, Pete might have some stuff going on and have an incident command post for public health or public works issues. Rusty might have some stuff going on law enforcement, and we would coordinate information across multiple command posts. So, for example, if you had boil water orders in three different parts of the county, instead of three press releases coming out of Camas, Washougal, Battleground, and LaCenter, we would have one press release that would say, here's the boil water situation in these three locations, so the public is all crystal clear on it. So we are support coordinators for them. Where Cressa's role gets unique is that we are also the informers of the policy group. So we have to be the notifiers of the state, so we are notifying the state of any type of mutual aid we need. And then we are also keeping our elected officials informed to make sure that we're staying within the confines of the laws and the legal ramifications. So the incident commander's the lead, Cressa supports it, but then we also have the connectivity to the state and the federal officials, and we have to jump through those chains in order to bring those resources down to the jurisdiction.
And is there a clear delineation between the different stages of an emergency? For instance, the crisis mode, it's upon us and we're just beginning to set things up and find out how to handle it, declaring the state of emergency, and then the duration of the state of the emergency, and then the recovery. How do you transition between those? How do you move from state of emergency to no longer are you state of emergency? You're recovering from it.
Response occurs when these response disciplines are responding directly to abate the threat. At the point at which the threat itself is abated or the hazard is essentially abated, then we get into the community recovery phase. So once Pete primarily deals with weather events, severe storms, storm is over, we've done what we can, the floodwaters have abated, then we get into community recovery. For law enforcement and fire, it's putting the fires out, abating the hazardous material situation, mitigating the threat. Essentially, when the first responders can go back to their daily job, then we're fully in the recovery phase. Because they go back to patrolling the streets and then the different things that they do, but then we still have a community that has flood-affected homes and different things that we have to then ensure gets back to normal as well.
Okay, and who makes the call to transition from one stage to another?
When we're asking you to declare an emergency, we're going to ask you for the duration at which we need the additional funds or need the laws changed. So, for example, in the H1N1 example I cited earlier, it was until we no longer needed paramedics to deliver the medication. And it really is situation specific. It could be a couple of days. It could be, you know, a couple of weeks. But response phases are typically not very long in overall duration.
So when we do make that call that says this is a state of emergency, are we at that time normally coupling that with a duration? State of emergency for X?
They will be typically say until the emergency is abated or until the end of the next calendar month. And so what happens is if it looks like it's going to be shorter than that, then we can limit it to a shorter time period. But typically, we've not had one that's needed extension, at least in the 8 years that I've been here.
Great.
So I'm curious, you mentioned civil liberties a couple times. I'm not quite sure what would that consist of and what type of civil liberty would you be asking to give up that's constitutional.
Sure. So there's a couple of different civil liberty scenarios that happen during any type of disaster. The very first one is curfew. Whether or not you want to establish a curfew for your community that says all law-abiding citizens need to be in their homes at, you know, this particular date and time so that we can handle issues of civil unrest or issues of looting. Things during Hurricane Katrina, I believe they had a 24-hour curfew involved in Hurricane Katrina because they wanted people to either be at the shelters or be at their homes, and those were requested by the agencies. Typically, if a civil liberty is being requested, it's because it fits into the scenario of what the FERC incident commander is dealing with. Other types of civil liberties might be freedom to gather. You might want to cease public events. For example, if we have a public health scenario that is spreading transmission of a particular disease at a rapid period of time, you might want not to have people gathering in large public events. You, of course, don't have the ability to change private events, but you do have the governing ability to cancel work for your employees. You have the ability to govern your public events and where people convene and gather, and those are very specific examples. Another example during the WTO riots was they weapons restricted inside public parks. And the reason they did that is because campaign signs that were being used against law enforcement officers to attack law enforcement officers. So they actually both defined what was considered a weapon at that point in time and also refrained weapons exposure in public parks. And so for a specific duration of time until the riots can stop. So civil liberties can be a wide variety of things. I mean, it's essentially your constitutionally defined areas, and you have to have very specific cause as to why you would do that and what the scenario would be and what the duration of time it would be to ensure public safety. Does that answer?
Well, kind of, because we removed something from our statute that removes the authority of the chairman of the board here to remove civil liberties, for example, because it's a fine line that we don't want to cross. So I was kind of curious. I guess it's more of a request of curfew and things of that mention, because that's a delicate place to go
for us
or anybody.
Yeah. What will happen during a emergency event is we will convene a policy meeting and we will say, this is the issue, here's the reason why the recommendation is being made, and then it will be your call whether or not to agree with the recommendation of your agencies that are making it. Typically, it's a law enforcement recommendation. I'll be honest, in the situations that I've seen across research across the United States, usually it's because of a very specific civil unrest issue. Now, we understand as emergency responders that the decisions you make on either side have very specific political ramifications. That's why we bring them to you as policy decisions.
Constitutional.
Absolutely. Well, they can also have public safety impacts as well. And so, it then becomes a very specific call of, your sheriff is making a particular recommendation, you're going against the recommendation, and, the media will be on either sides of those issues with regards to, whether or not people have lost their lives based on the decisions that you make.
And if I understand correctly, whatever policies we establish ahead of time to anticipate what the choices would be of removing civil liberties when it comes upon us, all of that goes out the window when it, well, let me rephrase that. all options are still on the table, that we have the freedom to set aside whatever ordinances or county or state law based on the best judgment that the person in charge has at the time to make that call.
Yes,
but hopefully we'll pay attention to what those pre-thought out policies are and let them guide us.
Sure. And we're never going to come to you with a willy-nilly, we think we should do X, Y, Z. It's going to very much have, here is why. And I will tell you, in every instance, it's going to be a life or death issue, because, you know, we're not looking at this as, hey, it's an emergency. It's also a convenient time to bring in civil liberties. That's not at all the scenario that we are dealing with. They are very critical decisions. They're very tough decisions. And they are also decisions that are fraught on either sides of the issue, because we can't tell you that, you know, guarantee 10 people will die because of this decision. They are often if this then that type of ethical decisions that you have to really work through. But that is also why we bring the risk manager, and also why your attorney will be with you to help guide you through the ramifications. Because I will tell you, the one known thing after every disaster, and it's happened in every disaster, are lawsuits. We get sued, not we, but emergency services always get sued after a disaster. In fact, the last lawsuit related to Mount St. Helens was just settled in the year 2010. So for 30 years, they faced lawsuits after Mount St. Helens. And so, you know, there's a lot of decisions, and there was a lot of policy decisions with Mount St. Helens about, you know, when to tell people to evacuate, when they could resume their businesses. And there was there's a lot of key decisions that you make, and some of those decisions have impacts all the way down the chain.
I think Carrie's still there.
Exactly. So the policies and procedures, that piece of it is that, you know, you're talking about our roles and responsibilities, and so that's all set as far as these are the procedures that we would go through to have that conversation, that ultimately to bring the recommendation from the incident commanders and from our commander and from your team to the policy level for us to then be asked to make a decision.
So roughly so. The first responders have the procedures and the protocols about how they respond to emergency incidences. And that's why we brought them all here together. So they've got the very how they respond tactically. That's why it's important we use the incident command system, because then we all speak the same language. I know they're going to have an incident commander across the board. I know what the expectations are and what the responsibilities of an EOC are. Because the reality is there's over 30 different agencies involved among all four of these disciplines. And so it's not just, you know, one fire chief. You know, we've got many, many fire agencies that all have to respond the same way to assure life safety. And then this comprehensive plan really serves as the umbrella for that. Here's the assumptions, here's what we think your responsibilities are going to be, and then the incident itself is going to define what parts of those roles and responsibilities we're into. So it doesn't get super micro detailed, but yes.
How well equipped are all of the players with radios and other resources that they will need, and how well does that cross the communications gap with Portland? If they were to ask us for help, or if we were to ask them for help, can we all get on the same page and the same frequency? Are radios all compatible? Interoperability?
We do have common channels with Portland. So anytime we have an incident factor frequently, we're over there helping them with either especially with around the drug task force or something like that. We're over there talking to the Portland folks. And they also have our frequencies. So we do have intercommunication.
So that base is well covered.
Yes. Yes. And it's not just law and fire as well, EMS for that matter, and then from agency to agency or discipline to discipline. So fire and law can talk to one another as well.
Great.
And I will just put a plug in, Donovan's on the CRESA Administrative Board. Our radio system right now is needing to be replaced, and it's something that right now we're on an analog system, we're not on a digital system, and so I don't know how much you could briefed by my boss or our board in regards to, I know Bill was on the radio replacement group, but there's some very significant dollar amounts coming down the pipe in regards to supporting the radio system changeover, which will occur.
I think we're due for an update on that, because the 500 megahertz system upgrade, we had lots of conversations early on. It was super expensive, remember, and then we kind of backed off of it, and Motorola kind of backed off, and everybody said, well, maybe it'll be less expensive, but it's been a while since we've gotten an update of where we are and when it would need to occur, so that that changeover would be good for us to have a little bit of, have a conversation as a board about that.
I'll take that back to my director, absolutely.
So at this point, there's a need, has there not been any provision set aside in a budget, or has any taxes already been designated for that up to this point?
Not taxes, but we have structured out a 20-year plan with regards to saving for that radio system. I don't know if you want to go more specifically into that. Or actually, David, our budget person is here. Can we get one?
Mark.
Go, Mark, sorry.
Not
budget. We're finance committee.
They just recently had a scoping session about a month and a half ago, and they'll be coming back with a little bit more refined information from that scoping session. I guess the report would be that the plan that we had put in place about a year ago to have the RFP, the contractor scope the RFP and do the current work is still viable. I mean, we're still in the right range of what we projected the cost and what they have now come back with this as the cost. So the plan that we put in place to prepare for that. And of course, the bills I hear, this presentation has been made to the Crescent Board. And so we are on track, and I would imagine by late fall, we'll probably have the RFP scope. So
maybe once you have that, could you bring it back to us and so that we could?
Sure, I'll talk to Anna. Anna would probably be the best person to come back. But I can be there with her.
Sure.
Being on the 24th, the executive steering committee for that radio replacement project is meeting. So we can give you new information there.
Speaking of new information, being that communication technology, along with anything that's basically related to computers, is changing so quickly that I assume that whoever is currently vetting that and defining whatever those specifications are, that they're keeping tuned in as to what new options are becoming available out there.
CRESA is very much involved in a lot of the next generation 911 efforts. Because radio is one thing, but data is a whole another ball of wax. And that is where 911 services will change very drastically to incorporate people providing pictures, video, and they call it next generation 911. And we're very much on the front end of counties that are pursuing the next generation 911 initiatives. We're also one of the first counties in the nation to incorporate social media and its emergency response and are doing that as well. So we're very much aware and tuned in to what's available. The struggle, I'll tell you, with next generation is going to be the vendors are getting themselves to a place where they are beginning to have next generation products, but the technology we have at a government infrastructure level is not up to pace in order to be able to incorporate those without some very significant investment. So there will be a lot of, and that will be, Anna and our technical manager can speak way more suitably to that, but there's challenges for government.
Okay, just related to that, it's a little bit of a tangent, but this is probably the only opportunity we have to actually put in the request. The social networking and those flash alerts that go out, I get them all the time, and they become junk mail to me. And it would be an improvement that I would just throw out here, just as an idea, that when people sign up for that, that somehow you allow them some options of what threshold and that they want to be notified at, because it's the boy who cried wolf. If we get those all the time, we're not going to pay attention when something significant happens. So that would be
the text alerts that we get, those 404 ones?
No, they're...
Where they come from?
The flash, what do you call them?
Flash alert is a user subscriber selection based. So it's based on who you choose to follow that you get the flash alerts with. So
how do I get them?
I don't know how you get those.
Generally,
people go to the website and sign up for their email address, and that's how they.
So they get emails.
Mm-hmm.
Or text.
You can also get it via text.
Okay, I think I have the text.
Well, that would be something.
Because I agree, because I get a ton of them, and I just they become.
That's less. Right, and so really the level that would be a very good way for citizens to be able to sign up for something and know they're not signing up for junk texts or junk emails. But be able to set the threshold. Some people, they have all the time in the world and they want everything. Other ones, time is very precious and they only want to know, is this important affecting me? So the ability for them to select that menu when they sign up would be go a long way for us really tuning in to when we need to tune in.
I'd love for you to send me an example of what it is you're talking about, because those are all things that you personally, I believe, get to set. CRESA doesn't control any of the notices on that. The only thing you get from us would be things that say CRESA alert in the email. And other than that, you're probably looking at websites, and I can direct you to the websites on where you can unsubscribe if you're following particular entities.
Would you?
So, yeah,
kind of as a follow-up, can you email us and let us know where it is that we get to set those preferences and see if we have the ability? Because right now, I don't, maybe somebody set it for us and we just get everything right now, but we can tailor it better.
That might be the case.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can follow every school in Clark County. Every, I mean, there's a lot of it. And I think it might be something that someone outside of our agency can follow.
Yes. We have, on our county website, we have The Grid, which puts all of our audio recordings, all of the PowerPoint presentations, all of the related documents, and anything that's going to be useful to the world out there. And this is a really good opportunity for any websites, any methods that people can use to sign up for participating, if there would be volunteer programs, training programs for those who want to participate and be equipped and ready for to be helped during an emergency, this would be a good time to be able to include that when you provide whatever you presented here to Mark so that we can include that.
Yeah, and I believe your stuff will be on the session materials. CRESA also has a website at CRESA911.org, which is where all the emergency management plans are posted at the emergency management level. Public Health has their plans on their side of the website, and different entities make decisions about what they share publicly as well. So, you know, a lot of that stuff is already out there. CRESA uses Facebook as well as Twitter. We have two different Twitter accounts, which is CRESA and CRESA Talk. Just want the emergency tweets if you follow on Twitter. If you follow CRESA, CRESA Talk has both emergency plus preparedness stuff. But there's two basic notifications, sort of things that are happening in the world. There's what we call wireless emergency alerts, and I'm wondering if this is what you might be talking about. Cell phone technology is in such a way that the cell phone providers and FCC are trying to figure out how to ping cell phones as everyone travels. So, for example, if you drive into Portland, and Portland has an active alert, if your cell phone's within that area, that they would ping your thing.
Those are pretty cool, by the way. The Amber Alerts, I've started to get on those, which is really interesting that they can do that.
Did you get that one where it set your phone off as an alarm?
Yeah.
When that Amber Alert?
It's bizarre. It's wild.
The challenge with those, and I was just in a presentation yesterday at our state conference, is a lot of agencies have access to ping them. So National Weather Service, State Patrol sends out the Amber Alerts. We have the power to issue them locally. We have not yet, although we're a certified COG, and the state of Washington can send them out at an emergency level, and the president. So there's a number of different originating sources. So that's coming. When that comes, cell phones will be in a better place. But we don't send out typically, you know, preparedness messages.
Whoever was in charge of this last Amber Alert, it was a really, it was scare the socks off a number of people. It did.
Yeah.
And it was a really good idea to alert people. But they overdid it. I mean, that scared the socks off people because it turned your phone into this. You never heard that alarm on your phone before. What's going on? And they overdid it. And after a while, it's like, ugh. So what? They could tone that back a little bit so that they don't go off a dozen times for the same alert.
And what the state of Washington has decided to do with that is not ping Amber Alerts between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. And that's a little bit frightening. I was at a meeting yesterday, and the concern about that is if someone's child goes missing during those hours, we'll wait until 6 a.m. to begin to send notices out. That could pose liability and issues. So there's a lot of stuff that's still being tweaked with a lot of the alerts. Just know that most of the stuff you're going to get from us during an emergency is going to come via email directly to you. It's going to say CRESA alert in the subject line of your email. And or you're going to get a message to your cell phone saying, join this meeting in progress because we're talking about policy issues.
So just one of those key pieces of information that what I'm encouraging you to do is to compile some kind of a document, written document that says, here's the links to the public health, here's the link to this, here's the link to that, here's how you sign up for this, and have some kind of a document and send it to our staff here, and we'll publish that in our grid so that they have one place that can point to all these other locations.
Perfect. Great. All right, well, let's stay informed of the situation. I want to also just go over making your next role is making the necessary policy decisions. We've been talking about these already in terms of issuing your emergency proclamations, appropriating money to meet disaster-related expenditures, issuing emergency orders, improving emergency ordinances. That would be also additional laws or ordinances that would need to be in place to manage the emergency. And then you may also be asked to delegate authority to an incident management team that is not just our emergency responders. If we were in a situation that was catastrophic enough, we may ask for a statewide team or a federal overhead team to come in and actually manage the emergency. In that case, we may be asking for a delegation of authority for you to define what powers you would delegate over to an incident management team and which ones you would say control of. And so those come to you as policy decisions. And then we also ask you to participate in regional policy coordination efforts. We here in Clark County, you probably heard me say this before, sit in two regions, the Portland Metropolitan Region and Southwest Washington Region. And the importance of that is because those two regions share one basic media market. And so we want to make sure if Washington County is making a policy decision and we're making a slightly different one, that we get the important folks together to make those decisions so that we can either do it in unison or clearly describe why those decisions that are being made in different jurisdictions are happening for different reasons. And so that's the reason we ask that we have one delegate that goes from our local policy group here into the regional policy coordination efforts, and that's typically our emergency commissioner. Any questions about that?
I guess I apologize for not being here in the first 13 minutes, but one of the things I was so impressed with Washington, D.C., I was both impressed and shocked at the, of course, Washington, D.C. only, at the number of law enforcement agencies that were involved, but somehow they had a handle of who was really in charge. And so I was impressed with that. I was impressed with the number of law enforcement. I thought it was a little overkill for the number that they had when they created their own traffic jam. So, but do we have that here? Because if we really had a big emergency here, we are in touch with the region of Portland. Who is in charge?
And that would be the incident commander. And usually that is the, initially it's the first person on the scene in leadership, and then they'll transition over to whoever the lead of that agency is. So, Rassian, if you want
to... Generally it's jurisdictional in nature, or it could be as broken out by discipline. So, for instance, if it's a terrorist incident and we're in pursuit of the bad guy, then law enforcement will probably be the incident command. Or there could be a unified command there where we might pull fire in if they've got to treat a lot of different casualties that have been exposed to something. But generally it's jurisdictional in nature, who's responsible for the incident. We would not expect Portland to come over here and take over an incident that originated in Clark County. It would be ours to do.
But we would be in touch with them, somewhat following the same procedure
right.
of conversation. It's something that you talked and planned about prior to.
And several years ago, CRESA had grant monies, and all of us went through pretty extensive incident command training.
Mm-hmm.
Because certainly in law and fire, they use that day in, day out. For public works, it was pretty important training so that we can speak the same language and participate in an effective manner on those things. So it was pretty valuable, and it's probably, as people change, it's important that we continue to provide that training to new people.
I didn't want to be reassured that when something big happened, and I know we've done regional things before, but when something really big was to really happen, that we didn't find ourselves in a turf situation, that we already had a pre-planned is how it would operate.
We work together well in emergencies. When it's not emergencies, sometimes not so well.
For example, the Clackamas Mall shooting had 22 law enforcement agencies that showed up to the Clackamas Town Center for that shooting they had back in December. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office was the lead agency the entire time. And our jurisdictions throughout the Portland metropolitan area and our 8-county footprint all subscribe to the incident command structure. So they understand very quickly, you know, which section they fall into, which, you know, missions and tasks they get. So it's the same language from local to federal. So also during an emergency, your basic role or your additional role is to ensure the continuity of government. This is really important with regards to what happens with your local county staff. You make decisions on either you discontinue your non-essential services and refocus them towards handling the emergency operation or assisting us in handling the emergency operation. Our staff at CRESA and my emergency operations center is only 6 full-time employees, and usually during an emergency it takes us about 60 to 70 volunteers and county or city employees that come in and help us to coordinate the response. And so often we've asked in the past, Bill Barron has redirected county staff in certain areas to help us fill in very task-oriented missions, and that would be within your purview as well. You also need to appoint officials to fill vacancies that are created by the disaster. So if, for example, key leadership positions within Clark County go missing or unaccounted for a particular time, we have to make sure that there's succession plans in place for each of those key leaders. We also ask you to provide a liaison to your local, state, congressionally elected officials. Depending on the size, scope, and scale, if the governor is in town and or the president, we will be asking for you to delegate who would be kind of the local connectivity point. Usually it's providing aerial tours to the president, you know, of affected areas. And so we would be looking for a liaison to who would network with the governor and the congressional staff.
I would think that the CRESA facility would be crucially important in the incident command communications. The question is, if you lose power, the whole grid goes down. Are your communications are going to work? Are all your computers going to continue to get air conditioning so they don't overheat? Is all that well thought out, and are you well equipped that way?
We prepare ourselves to respond to emergencies from paper to technology. So if we do not have access to any type of power, we also have backup systems with amateur radio. We have backup centers employed with Washington State Patrol. So if our building is affected in a particular way, we can transition over the phone lines. We also have partnerships throughout the state of Washington. So for example, if we are out completely here, relationships with folks in Spokane that would be able to help us facilitate the emergency response. There's a number of technology systems that overplay in any type of emergency. And if you read disaster research, usually not all of them go down at once. Even in the most critical earthquakes that we see in Haiti and Christchurch, New Zealand, you get spotty coverage in different ways, shapes, or forms. So radios may work, but computers may be down and vice versa. Text may work and cell phones may be out. So what we will likely face in an emergency is really a patchwork of what is working, what is not. Systems will be quickly assessed, we'll evaluate what we have, and we will develop how our alternate communication plan will occur. So there are a number of different communication plans in place regionally of what the assets are. It'll be a matter of figuring out what's affected during the crisis.
Yeah, got that there's lots of diverse kinds of choices, alternate choices. The question is, when it comes to the physical resources at CRESA, for instance, virtually every server room has UPS backups to be able to provide to keep your computer systems up and going. But the air conditioning system that keeps that system from overheating and going offline takes a lot of power. And the question is, if you lose power to that building and your emergency generators kick in, can you sustain 12 hours or 24 hours or longer and keep your computer system operating?
If you would talk about your displacement exercises when you go out the battleground, I think that'll answer some of that continuity of operations.
Well, yes, we have backup centers in place in terms of we could evacuate the building. In terms of generator and fuel supply, we're supplied for 10 days. So we can keep things running for about 10 days in operation at CRESA. Beyond that, we share the county server room with you guys. And so what is the resources in the county server room is, and my tech services manager can speak more eloquently than I can, but we share that space as a part of the lease from the county. So.
Okay, so I would think that Mark, we better make sure that our HVAC system, something that is so foreseeable when you think about it rationally, but you don't foresee it when you lose power and you say, well, we got backup, but everything overheats and it's offline. Will our phone systems still continue to operate if there's no power to the building and your emergency power kicks in?
You don't have to give away phones here.
Not yet.
Standard phones. And the power for the phones comes through the phone line, and it's not dependent on the
power. And for the building, our facility here, this building,
Same way. Phones keep working.
Okay, good. Just want to.
Different story.
Okay. Cheryl, didn't you guys cover for Calix on dispatch for a little bit?
Yeah.
They had a power outage up there that's similar to what the
region was. Yeah, just recently, actually. I think it was 2 or 3 months ago.
So you can use regional assets.
We can switch.
As well.
We have what are called phone switches and can switch over the dispatching. So we covered Calix during a 911 outage. And then we've done so in Portland as well, back and forth. So
yeah.
We have capabilities that
we've got great confidence that you have alternate ways to operate in case this goes down. My focus here is to ensure that this system does not go down, that we've thought through and we do have the infrastructure in place so that it still continues to work and we
right.
don't have to
and
resort to that.
Well, and Cheryl, we've got 10 days.
We've got 10 days.
And how much do we have, Mark? Like for county, because we have generators as well. We have big old diesel generators. I mean, how much?
Power every system in this building.
But for critical systems, how much time?
I don't know how much fuel we have, how many days capacity we have.
We should find out. It's a good thing.
We test that every week.
We do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We test the fuel to make sure that it's clean and not contaminated so that we won't have a malfunction caused by bad fuel. And the tanks are topped up on a regular basis.
How big is the tank?
And I will tell you, there probably won't be a day that we will ever be fully able to secure every building for an indefinite period of time, because they come down to resource questions. They come down to the amount of support that the agencies get, and balances in their budget. So the risk tolerance is something that has to be determined both for you as a county and then as an agency as well. So we feel 10 days would allow us to develop what that backup plan would be if we needed to go beyond 10 days. Recent disaster history, or since we've been in alive since 83, I believe, we've not had a situation that's caused us to go over those 10 days.
And that's 10 to 24/7.
10 to 24/7. And we have generators on our radio sites in terms of the communication.
Is Clark PUD, our electricity provider, are they part of the team, and do they... have they got a plan that will do what that will maximize the reliability of cell phone coverage in case we have a regional outage?
Clark PUD is not responsible for cell phone coverage within the jurisdiction. What oftentimes happens during disaster response is your Verizon, your different cell phone providers come in and bring what are called CAOs, cellular operated on wheels, and they bring CAOs into jurisdictions in order to set up tentative cellular sites. So even if you have large radio towers, for some reason the cell towers all went down, we had no cell coverage, there would be some temporary structures put into place, and you'll see assets raised into a jurisdiction to develop that communication mm-hmm. infrastructure right away. It's not pretty in the first few days of an emergency event, but those assets come from private entities.
Do they automatically, of their own initiative, just simply implement that?
It depends on the proverbial emergency response, because some comes at a cost, some comes at a donation, and those are things, of course, we'll be keeping everyone abreast about of what resources are coming in. Private sector resources we have no control over, and unfortunately critical infrastructure is about 90% owned by private sector entities. So, we can't necessarily commandeer, we can make the request, they can provide the support and the response that we need, but...
Sure. So I assume that they would want to be a valuable asset in wanting to do what they can in case of an emergency. So I would, if we haven't already built relationships with them and worked with them to collaborate so that they know what your preference would be, this whole team, then I would think that would help to ensure that the community can continue to communicate, because we've been proactive and we've approached the cell phone companies and they know how they can respond and they can tune into the incident command network.
Yes. The challenge, and we have a lot of relationships in place with private and public sector partnerships. The reality, though, is that not everyone does things just for the community good. A lot of times, particularly in the private structure, it's for what makes business sense for them at the time. And so in some cases, they'll do the community good with regards to the business write-off, but it's very difficult for government entities to go out and say, this is what we think we'll need, and for them to make any level of commitment, because they only want to do it in the time in which the need is present.
I understand, and I respect that. But at least if we have the conversation with them, and they would come back and say, well, in order for us to do that, to cooperate with you, that would cost this. Well, at least we have some kind of a potential prearranged plan that we can fall back on and say, yeah, remember that plan A for your communication? We authorize it, and so that it's available in case we need it.
And I'll tell you that on the technology front, our businesses won't give us quotes unless we give very specific and detailed specifications on what it is that we need. And one of the things that it's very difficult right now going out after, we have a company helping us develop the specifications for the replacement of the radio system, because it requires a very specific technical expertise, and people won't even throw out ballpark figures. And you'll know from the radio replacement project, we've gotten figures anywhere from $35 to $90 million. And so how do you plan for that? You plan for the 90 and the 35. It becomes very, very challenging because the systems we deal with are very, very intricate on a public safety side. So, you know, I've been in conversations like that regularly, and of course they smile and laugh and say, tell us what you really need when you need it, and we'll tell you how many millions or zeros you can add behind it. So it becomes very difficult to plan from a public safety or public entity side of it, because we can't just, you know, say, okay, it's going to cost $4 million. 4 years down the road,
for,
you know,
sure. Just the last, the wrap up on that. I understand that there are obstacles there, there are challenges there, but we want to make sure that we don't just simply not try because of those, but we at least reach out and see if there would be some of those entities that would be willing to work with us and say, yeah, we've got a plan, we'd be happy to cooperate with you. That's all.
All right, I think we're with this the last one. Oh, one more. So one final thing in terms of what you guys can do is we ask that you model emergency readiness. We ask that you prepare your family and friends to be self-sufficient for at least 3 to 10 days, if not longer. Of course, we're going to ask you to participate in emergency trainings and exercises as they occur. We want you to make sure that you know your facility safety protocols and know that county employees are practicing those regularly. We did actually just observe a fire drill, I think, at this building last week, and that was great. And ensure that the county has an effective continuity of operations plan so that you're ready to manage the county during the next emergency. The handout we've given you in the binder here covers really your executive role during emergencies. It gives you your checklist, these responsibilities that we've already outlined, as well as the information sharing protocol for both of the regions, the Portland region and the Southwest Washington region. And then in the back, there's one final page on the types of emergency plans. And you'll see from this very last page, so the types of emergency plans, there's a zillion of them. It's not just one, before you stay on the comprehensive plan, but this really defines whose responsibility is it. Is it something CRESA is involved in, or is it something you as a jurisdiction need to ensure that you have ready for your county and your jurisdictions? So with that, I just want to make sure you have, if you had any feedback on the comprehensive plan that we submitted.
Cheryl, would you recommend, you know, we haven't backfilled our COOP position, our liaison position, for about a year and a half. Would you recommend that we fill that?
Of course. Any county or jurisdiction of size, and this has happened, I know, both in the county and city of Vancouver, that they eliminated through their continuity positions. It really takes a full-time position to manage continuity and exercise and training to be sure that your county employees are ready to go for any type of disaster. CRESA can't train all of your employees, so those responsibilities very much fall to you as a county. And that goes everything from, you know, folks knowing first aid CPR to knowing active shooter response. I mean, it's there's a lot of different hazards that you could face across your county platform. And so absolutely, you know, we've certainly seen a lot less activity on the county front since that position has not been filled.
Right, Commissioner, so we did, in my prior role, we did request from the Vacancy Review Committee permission to replace Elizabeth Vaughn when she left. That request was returned to us without action. If you entertain considering it, we'll resubmit.
Well, bring it to board time.
Yeah.
Exactly. We can have the discussion about that.
Yep.
As part of our vacancy review.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah, is that okay?
Yep.
So any feedback you have on the plan or any final questions that we can entertain?
We've got great confidence in you.
And you should have confidence. We're a very proactive and group that works well together. If you were to compare the counties, I think in the Portland metropolitan area, we have one of the most progressive emergency response structures, and we're always looked at on the state of Washington as being one of the counties that really does have emergency response together. You know, the challenge, though, of no crisis goes cleanly handled. There will be problems. There will be communication problems. There will be systems that fail. There will be people that fail. I mean, that is just simply a reality of all disasters, and we will be sued. I mean, those are things I give you great confidence in, which is not what any politician wants to hear. But what we can tell you is that we want to make sure that you are as informed as you can be. And if you begin receiving those calls at an elected official level of what are you doing to handle it, hopefully you've heard from us already. But if you've not, please get on the short phone to connect with the emergency. And most of our risks and hazards here, you get some notification of. They're mostly weather related. And they're mostly, you know, a couple days in advance, you're going to begin getting the, here's what we're starting to do about it. As we get into winter, flooding and wind are the two basic things that we deal with a lot, as well as some law enforcement hazardous materials response. But, you know, for the most part, most things come with notice. Your earthquake's not going to come with notice. Your tornadoes are not going to come with notice. Those are things that can very much spawn up easily here in this jurisdiction. And, of course, a law enforcement situation rarely has notice, so active shooter-type situations, but they are all potential hazards that we could face here.
Okay, just one last point, and that is that, if I understand correctly, Clark PUD, our electricity provider, they do a great job, and I'm surprised how quickly they get in and get power back up after an emergency. But I just wonder if they're even tuned into and they have access to the communication network or the gas, those that can shut off main gas supply valves to a region, if those kinds of entities are tuned in and so that they can receive the whatever they need to get out there from the incident commander to know where to pinpoint and shut that thing off or
and
turn that thing on.
During an emergency response, we bring those critical entities into the emergency operations center. So PUD is sitting right next to Public Works.
Oh, they are.
Right next
to
schools and Red Cross. So that's the value of the coordination center, is that we bring all the support and coordination entities. And PUD has its own op center, so they're doing all their tactical response
and power
up. But they're sitting right next to Public Works and CTRAN and all of our critical stakeholders.
Northwest Natural.
Northwest Natural is usually sitting in Portland's Emergency Operations Center, but we're connected very closely by phone. Yep.
Good. Then you've already covered that base.
Yeah.
That's great.
We bring, and I should describe it, we'd love to do tours of the EOC with you, but we bring the stakeholders in. That's why I say it's six of us, seven of us full time, but we bring key stakeholders in so that they coordinate and get the face-to-face as well as the phone connectivity to provide support for the incident commanders that we have. So, and depending on the incident, those faces and players can change depending on who is important. Sometimes it's Chamber of Commerce. Sometimes it's, you know, depending on what we're dealing with at the given time. So.
For our specific roles in this, I really appreciate you focusing in on what our specific roles and responsibilities are. And then during the course of an event, who calls us and who we need to call will change.
We don't
get citizen calls while the fire is burning necessarily, that 911 get the calls on that. It's after the house burned down that they're coming in and saying, why won't somebody help us? Where can I go? That's when we need to be able to have the resources available to say, in a recovery phase, who can they go to? I think so, for me, what would be valuable for us as policymakers is, during each phase of the crisis, knowing what we can reasonably expect, who we're going to need to be in touch with, and making sure we have the contact information and the information in general to be able to make the right call. So having that as we move forward would be great from my perspective of being able to answer the call that comes.
And in previous disasters, I have worked with Mark as the General Services Director, but typically Bill in his role as the County Administrator, is any concerns, questions, you feel free to get to him. He posts directly to me, and we should be giving you that information as a course of action. And I will tell you that state and federal response is sometimes unpredictable and makes people very unhappy. I will tell you FEMA will start crawling around the jurisdiction after a flooding event, sometimes before the response is over, and we will begin to receive calls of, you know, we're getting FEMA folks on our doorstep doing house visits, and they haven't even connected with the Emergency Operations Center. So it's a layered response, and sometimes those things will come directly to your desks, people of concern and citizens of concern. But we want to assure you that the communication between us and you guys should be hopefully crystal clear.
Perfect. Thank you. Thanks for all your work on this. Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for it.
Great.